It's been a really coordinated effort over the past 10 years. I think they're finally seeing, pun intended, the fruit of their labor, you know, with that intentionality. So I think it's an exciting time for the cranberry farmers who are staying in the business, trying to innovate and figure out how to survive.
That's Kendra Nordine Beato, a Boston-based Monitor staff writer who explores gender, sports, food, and lots of crossovers. Kendra was a nominee for a James Beard Foundation Media Award in 2011 for a story on American culinary renaissance. She made food history a focus of her study for her master's degree in American Studies at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Last year, she wrote an explainer for The Monitor about U.S. Thanksgiving history and then came on this podcast to talk about it. Part of this episode is an encore of that episode since history holds up so well. But Kendra has just been out on and in a cranberry bog, going even deeper, immersing, you might say, on a key culinary component of this holiday story. And she's back to talk about her reporting. This is Why We Wrote This. I'm Clay Collins. Hey, Kendra, welcome back.
Thanks, Clay. Great to be back.
First thing, news point. I shared with you a story earlier this month from The Guardian about how U.S. expats to Britain have stirred new interest in the Thanksgiving holiday there. Your favorite stat at a glance was that pumpkin spice is up more than 550%
right.
In the place from which the Pilgrims and Puritans departed. Maybe they were grateful that Americans left. I don't know. What's with this reverse culinary colonialism?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, well, for starters, I think it's popular among the younger generations, Gen Z, millennials. What's not to love about turkey, stuffing, mashed potatoes, gravy, the comfort food? I think probably a lot of young students have had time in the United States and maybe are bringing those traditions back with them. But, you know, it's not that far off from British food history. It was already a tradition to have poultry with fenberry or gooseberry, which are cousins of the cranberry, which is why the settlers in the New World took to the cranberry pretty quickly as soon as they got here, learning how to use it from the Wampanoag tribe and incorporating it into their diet.
That poultry was probably not turkey, right?
What's so interesting about the turkey is that it was a Native American bird that then was traded into the Middle East trading companies. And so when the bird arrived in Britain, it was from the Turkish trading route. So they called it the turkey. So at some point, yes, people were eating turkey in the old country, too. But it could have been anything. You know, these extravagant fowls, you bring them out to the big banquet table, were designed to impress.
Let's cut to cranberries. We started last year's episode with the perennial debate over how best that side dish is served, and opinions are very strong. So we'll leave that out this time. You just wrote a cover story for our weekly magazine about this tart berry that is closely associated with Massachusetts, as closely as the grapefruit is with Florida, really, although our state has been progressively more squeezed, as you write, by Wisconsin and eastern Canada. How did cranberries become a magazine cover story? What was the genesis of your pitch?
Well, it was actually last spring when I was reporting on Massachusetts small farmers and how they were surviving funding cuts. And I was in a conversation with someone at UMass Amherst who mentioned the cranberry as the state's number one agricultural product. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, wow, you know, that's really true. The cranberry is something that you think of Cape Cod cranberries. It's just part of the holiday traditions here. And yet I had never seen a cranberry in the wild, so to speak. And I also was really intrigued. I had been hearing stats over the years when we report on Thanksgiving food numbers that Wisconsin, for the past 30 years, has been the biggest producers of cranberries in the United States. I was curious, why was that happening? And what was happening with cranberries on Cape Cod? So I set out to find out.
So Wisconsin edging out Massachusetts.
Yes.
Why Wisconsin?
I've often wondered that myself, having grown up there partly, and it was always the cheese state, you know, the dairy state. But a good metaphor to think about is the way streets are laid out in Boston, and then maybe think about, you know, Chicago, which is like a grid. The bogs in Massachusetts were hand-carved in the early 1800s when people started realizing they could take these wild varieties and cultivate them into a crop. And so one by one, neighbors start hand-carving these bogs and then cultivating the wild varieties. Wisconsin also has native cranberries and part of their own indigenous history there in culinary usage, but just more access to more land that isn't as expensive as land prices are in Massachusetts. So therefore, after studying, you know, how Massachusetts was doing their bogs, they set out and made very laser-leveled bogs, straight, so easy to mow, easier to grow more varieties. And then also, there were varieties being developed in New Jersey, and so they could very quickly adopt those higher-yielding varieties and plant those. So now Massachusetts is trying to catch up a bit with some of the techniques that Wisconsin has perfected, including the wet harvest, because it used to be that Massachusetts was primarily using a dry harvest, where they just used these large lawnmower-type machines with combs in the back that would comb the berries out of the dry vines and into bags. And then they would schlep them, you know, they call them lumping the bags. But the wet harvest, you go through with a machine that's almost like an egg beater, and it knocks the berries off the vine into the water. And every berry has, if you split it open, it's four components of pockets of air. So they wear their own little life jackets. So they float to the surface, and then they're easy to vacuum up. Much quicker, more cost-efficient way to harvest the cranberries that Wisconsin really perfected. And yeah. So now Massachusetts is trying to apply some of those same techniques.
Your story is really character rich. You begin with Equus Trundy, who is leading an agrotourism group through a bog. You take us back in history to the Boston journalist who wrote Memoir on Cranberry Sauce,
right.
And the lawyer who became decades later known as Mr. Cranberry.
Who gave us canned cranberry sauce.
We'll have to thank him for that.
Yes.
There are eight generation families of growers, growers who take really different tacks, ones who work for big corporations. Talk about some of the characters in your piece and how they illustrate the importance of the crop historically and what's going on with it now.
Right. So the first person I talked to was a second generation cranberry farmer, John Mason, and his father ran a small bog and he grew up loving the cranberry and the cranberry harvest, eventually buying his family farm from his parents and raising his family there, and then also starting to innovate with some of the things that what the cranberry farmers are realizing is that they have to improve their 100-year-old bogs in order to have higher yields of cranberries to stay competitive as the market is literally getting flooded from these other sources like Wisconsin and Eastern Canada and some other places.
And coping with things like temperature changes, which affect how cranberries grow.
Yeah, right. Because the main thing with cranberries is you need water to protect them from deep freeze, because as the bud is turning into a berry, they will flood the bog. And even if it freezes, that will protect the berry for a couple of weeks until it thaws again. But the problem is with extended drought that we've been having, is that the soil immediately absorbs the water. And so it's getting a lot harder to flood the bog quickly enough to protect it from when we do get those temperature drops. Another character that you were mentioning, we went and talked to Cindy Rhodes, and she married into a cranberry family, third generation cranberry farmers. And it was during a particularly bad turn when the market was flooded with too many berries and they were having to borrow money to pay money, they said. And she was asking, why don't we have frozen cranberries? Ocean Spray, which is the dominant cooperative in Massachusetts, their theory was buy one bag fresh and another bag to put in your freezer. And that was how you would have frozen cranberries. But she thought, why don't we sell frozen cranberries? And so she went to set about innovating how you can package and market that, and went store to store in Massachusetts trying to get places to sell her berries in the organic section. And then the third couple, Jordan and Equus Trendy, but Equus is listed as a cranberry grower, even though her husband Jordan is equally as involved. Their background is IT. And during the pandemic, They just decided to buy this cranberry farm, and they've been doing it ever since. They're younger. They realize that there's this increase of people going to farmers markets. They want to know their farmers. They want to know where their food is coming from, that people really want to go see where the cranberry comes from mm-hmm. and get into the bog when they flooded it so they can harvest it. So their agritourism business makes them more money than just the actual harvest of the cranberries.
Wow, they went back to the land, and in this case, the land was a bog.
They got bogged down, yes.
So clearly at this length of reporting, you also had room to nerd out on the crop itself, besides meeting all of these interesting
yes.
characters. So you write about heritage strains, about higher yielding
yeah.
hybrid varieties,
yeah.
about wet harvest versus dry, sanding vines, about the bounce principle of
yes.
sorting berries.
All of that.
What in your reporting surprised you most about the humble cranberry?
Well, it's actually something you didn't mention
okay.
and something that I didn't really talk about because I didn't have room in my story. But every cranberry farmer has to custom make their own machinery because there's no line of cranberry harvesters. And so they've somehow built these contraptions, you know, hoses to vacuum them up, and they help each other because maybe they need to borrow equipment or maybe their equipment isn't working, and so they troubleshoot together. Jordan Trundy says, you know, cranberry farmers are great problem solvers, and there's all these little things, and it's like miniature farming. I don't know how to describe it otherwise, because when you're standing on the bog, which is quite bouncy, and it's not wet, cranberries don't grow in water. People have that impression because of the commercials that they've seen. But it's layer upon layer of sand and then vines that grow on the sand and then mm-hmm. shooting upward. And so it's very unique. And some people still use antique harvesting equipment that's like that are decades old to collect the berries. This is the smaller farmers. Some of the larger industrial farms, like they have like huge Mack trucks that are scooping
sure.
up the berries and carting them off to Ocean Spray and things like that.
But unlike the cider business or the maple syrup business, which has a supporting infrastructure, they're actually winging it. And that creates
a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. But and they all said cranberry farmers really cooperate with each other because another thing they have to share is water. The Trundys, they flood their bog by damming a slow moving river, and they're the last farmers downstream. So they have to coordinate with their neighbors. When are you doing your harvest? And everyone's trying to hit the peak harvest.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this rolling harvest that comes down. And even John Mason gets his water from a nearby pond. He'll flood the bog, and then the water goes back into the pond. And then the next cranberry farmer will flood the pond and goes back in. I think he said there's some limited number of people who have access to that pond. So there's a lot of coordinating that has to happen between the different farmers, and they all know each other. I mean, there's less than 400, but more than 300, I think, just in what they call the South Coast of Massachusetts, which is the Carver, Wareham towns. And one thing I did learn is that only 10% of cranberries are produced on Cape Cod now. That's the other sort of news item that drew me to this story, is that 10 years ago, when the cranberry industry in Massachusetts was taking a look at itself and saying, wow, we're really being outpaced by Wisconsin, they came up with a plan to help farmers renovate their bogs, laser level them so that you take less water, plant higher yielding varieties, and also if they were ready to get out, to use money from the state to convert their land into wetlands to preserve the rural nature of the South Coast and not sell to developers who would then just, you know, turn it into more housing. So it's been a really coordinated effort over the past 10 years. I think they're finally seeing, pun intended, the fruit of their labor, you know, with that intentionality. So I think it's an exciting time for the cranberry farmers who are staying in the business, trying to innovate and figure out how to survive.
Yeah. Thanks for taking us all the way through laser leveling. That's not something that I think I saw in the piece either, but thank you for that. We're going to dip back now into a nice big helping of our episode from last year about Thanksgiving history more broadly, and we'll bookend that by hearing what you're doing for the holiday this year. So whatever version of this holiday's origin story you prefer, and however you like to spend it and with whom, whether it's, you know, a big intergenerational family in the Norman Rockwell style or with a small chosen family of friends, Thanksgiving often, not always, but often involves genuine gratitude, a little time off from work, and food. So, Kendra, my own menu option hill to die on is a hill of fresh cranberry relish versus the gelatinous stuff that takes the shape of a can. What is your hardline Thanksgiving stand, if you have one?
Oh, Clay, I've had to learn to not have a hardline stand, but I'm definitely team fresh cranberry
nice.
Relish with a orange peel grated in with walnuts. That's a tribute to my Midwestern upbringing, I
maple
think.
Maple syrup?
Maybe a little bit of maple syrup
yes,
for
yep.
a hint of New England. That's
yep.
right.
Get that sugar out of there.
Yeah. My husband is team canned cranberry sauce with the ridges.
Ooh.
They just like to have it in a big blob. And so often I'm the, you know, lonely person eating the cranberry relish all to myself around the Thanksgiving table. But it's still, we have both. We have to have both.
I've been in Thanksgiving dinners like that.
Yeah.
Let's go to turkey. Turkey's okay, right? People brine it, they deep fry it, they stuff it, you know, they dry it out sometimes. You can get farm fresh ones if you can afford it, get past the factory farming piece. But turkey is so ingrained, and I wonder why. Also, did Ben Franklin want to make the turkey a national bird, or was that just an early dad joke?
It's just get that myth abolished. People always bring that up as, oh, did you know that mm-hmm. Ben Franklin thought the turkey should be the national bird?
In which case we'd be eating eagle.
And right. That's,
yeah.
you know, not good. Actually, Ben Franklin wrote that sentiment in a private letter that he sent to his daughter that was rediscovered by historians, then published, and then, and you know, discovered as what Ben Franklin really thought the national bird should be. But he was making fun, actually, of the Society of the Cincinnati, which was a heritage society that had this bald eagle, probably riffing on the national seal at the time, but it was badly drawn. It looked like a turkey. So he was poking fun at it, as the satirist that he is. So,
wow.
Yes,
okay.
Dad joke, early dad joke for Thanksgiving.
That's excellent. And you have team spiral ham, too. Vegetarianism can kind of soar on Thanksgiving, though, too. All those sides. And
heavy sides, yes.
Yeah, and a meatless Three Sisters Thanksgiving would be corn, beans, and squash. That'd be appropriate.
Right.
You've written about Wampanoag autumn stew. You told me on the way in here that actually included venison, but that's game, not, you know, store meat. So, you know, make the case, if you would, for a meatless Thanksgiving.
Okay, well, let's just take a look first at history. The early settlers that first year in Plymouth had been through a very difficult year. None but four of the original 18 English housewives had survived in a colony of about 50 men. And that autumn, there was an abundant harvest. And so that thus begins the myth when the members of the Wampanoag tribe had some diplomatic feasts. Mm-hmm. We don't know if there's actually turkey there. There was only one eyewitness account written in 1621 that referenced fowl. And so fowl has come to mean turkey, because turkey was an abundant native bird to North America. Meat was a special ingredient, especially for those early settlers, which is why the Wampanoag were teaching the English settlers about the Three Sisters. And for the listeners who don't know what that is planting corn, bean, and squash all in the same mound of dirt. And the corn supports the bean stalk, and the squash spreads out to eliminate weeds and other sort of invading pests. So, but together in the pot, they create this very nutritious dish of both protein and carbohydrates and even sugar. So vegetarianism or vegan is no longer synonymous with a difficult dinner guest. It's something that more people are adapting. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of dietary niches these days that people no longer hide. They talk quite openly about them. But meatless Thanksgiving, you can do a lot. I have quite a few friends who are vegetarians who either just have delicious roasted autumn squashes and macaroni and cheese, always is an appeasing side, and mashed potatoes, stuffing, of course. I mean, really, nobody should be thinking too much about calories at Thanksgiving. So just load it up with all those carbs, and you don't need to have a meat. Some people have had tofurkey. Personally, I've never had tofurkey, mm-hmm. but I hear it's a decent stand-in for people who want to reduce their meat
sure.
consumption.
Ideally, it's the most browsable meal of the year. And you could
Right.
You could get by on sides if you wanted to pretty easily.
Yeah, or the bread basket or right. dessert. I mean, you have to save room for dessert.
We hinted at the sort of contentiousness even of accounts of the first Thanksgiving and what that meant for relations between Indigenous people and colonists. That's its own conversation. Politics in general is a notoriously problematic table topic, even in less chaotic times than these. But we can leave that aside for a moment, too. What about good-natured debates over regional fare? Is the Mason-Dixon line, for instance, also the pumpkin sweet potato pie line?
Right. So a couple of years ago, I interviewed Maya Harrell, who grew up in Georgia, and she's a self-described pie nerd. Hmm. She had started working in a pie shop in high school, studied the history of Black women and pie making in graduate school, and then launched her own business, Lord of the Pies. Hmm. And she told me something unexpected happened when she would go to her farmer's markets and set out slices of pumpkin pie and sweet potato pie. And she told me she had never, growing up as a Black Southern woman in a Black family, had never had pumpkin pie until she started working in a pie shop and found it quite bland. Mm. But anyway, so she would set out her two pieces of orange pie. And she said that a lot of her Black customers would come up and say to her, well, I know my Black card's going to be revoked, but I prefer pumpkin over sweet potato pie. Mm. That's what she told me. Mm. And then she said even more surprising would be her white customers who would come up and he had never even seen sweet potato pie. And they would wonder, is it sweet? Is it savory? And she had to explain what sweet potato pie was. And she said, without fail, those customers were also from the North. Mm. So historically, pumpkins don't grow well in Southern heat. But that's not the only reason for the absence of pumpkin pie. Thanksgiving was originally perceived as a holiday forced on the South by the victorious North after the Civil War. And, you know, you could say the arrival of pumpkins is just another pie in the face. And sweet potatoes are central to Black Southern cuisine. They have a long history in the slave trade, the yam, and plantation cook. So there is a bit of a regional identity that happens. And certainly some regions will say, well, it's only going to be Thanksgiving if you have collard greens or include macaroni and cheese, or you have to have Jello, you know, in the form of a turkey. So it's going to, food fights or good natured food fights are going to depend on where you grew up and your own family's history.
Right. I want to zoom out a little because when we had a pre-conversation about this, at one point, I think you said that in some ways, regional and even national food is becoming so much less of a thing. I mean, what it looks like now is, I think you said not even fusion, but chaos. So you have people sort of clinging to their respective traditions, but you also have a lot of seep through and crossover going on.
I wrote a story that's looking at a cookbook trend that is sort of debunking the idea that there's authentic cuisine because so many people have multicultural backgrounds. It's always been the case as people are moving around the world. That's always been true, and exchanging cultural knowledge and information through food and dishes. And so any dish that you look at is kind of layers and layers of influence. It may have different names, but it might have similar techniques. The pumpkin was discovered by Spanish conquerors, one theory goes, who took them home to show them to Queen Isabella, who started thinking this was part of the riches from the New World. Mm-hmm. And also when you had some of the English settlers going back and forth between England and the New World, they were bringing back pumpkins, which then became incorporated into European cooking. And the French started writing about pompions in cookery books as early as the 1600s. So pumpkins and turkeys are both indigenous to North America. So that's why when you look at some dishes in Mexico, they may remind you of something that was happening also in the English colonies up north. So it is fascinating to follow the history of ingredients as they move around in the global trade.
That's really interesting. What else is changing about Thanksgiving? Old gender roles always seem to be in play. Talk about the piece you wrote on how to run interference on some of that.
Right. So, well, let me just say that I have to give a shout out to Sarah Joseph Hale, who is credited with the campaign that convinced Abraham Lincoln to declare a national day of Thanksgiving during the Civil War. And this idea of a turkey on the table, feeding the crowd, is really a New England tradition. As we pointed out, it's sort of murky how it all got started and why that became part of the nation's founding myth. But Sarah Joseph Hale was a writer, a magazine publisher, and she had authored a novel in 1827 where she's romanticizing the role of the turkey and describes it as the roasted turkey took precedence on this occasion, being placed at the head of the table, and well did it become its lordly station. So she is promoting this ideal over and over and over and over again, writing to lawmakers. And finally, Abraham Lincoln makes one day. It didn't become a national holiday until the next century. But what I want to say about all that is this idea of a woman cooking the turkey, feeding her children and her husband and relatives is such a core part of nation building in the United States. It's amazing that it has persevered, that it has over the centuries. We certainly embrace it as turkey and its crowning place at the Thanksgiving table. But okay, so what happens when nation building starts to change and men and women especially are filling different roles now in life? You don't necessarily have a woman raising children. She's also might have a career. She may not get married. She may not have children. There's plenty more choices and reflections in society. What Americans are today, what I found as a single woman marching through the decades, really, until I got married, is that I would arrive at a Thanksgiving meal and no two Thanksgivings ever looked alike for me because it depended on where I was.
Except the Detroit Lions were always on TV, right?
Right, except for the Detroit Lions. And in any case, so when you arrive at the door, let's say you're a guest, inevitably, you are going to have the women fussing around in the kitchen and the men are going to be parked in front of the TV watching football. There are some crossovers happening there. Yes, there'll be some men in the kitchen. There'll be some women watching football. But that's generally, it's a very strange gender divide. Suddenly, that's what you're experiencing. At least that was my experience. And so I always didn't really know where to go because, you know, I was in another woman's house. I couldn't necessarily take over in the kitchen. And yeah, I like football. I'll watch it, but I'm not like a hardcore football fan. So I wrote a column about trying to survive that dichotomy and whether it's attempting to bring a side that would either kind of be not so enthusiastically received because it didn't, you know, fit into the menu. But what I learned from my mother-in-law, who also, and a lot of people do this, you have to navigate, where am I going to be? Am I going to be a guest? Am I going to be the quarterback in the kitchen, right? So she had found that since she was going with her daughter's family to her mother-in-law, the other mother-in-law, that she would prepare a Thanksgiving meal on Wednesday for her and her husband. And she said it would fill the house with these lovely smells. Yeah. And then they would go have the meal. And then on Friday, they could have leftovers. So being in the blended family that I am, I have two stepchildren who also are spending time with their mother and then also with us. So I've kind of adopted this as a nouveau Thanksgiving tradition. And often Wednesdays is when we make the big meal. And then on Fridays, we gather with our family. And we actually have a really great tradition that started during the pandemic. And we all wrote down 10 things that we were grateful for and put them in a box. And then we pass the box around the table and you pull one out and you read it as long as it's not your own. Gratitude. And I am so surprised, but the children, the kids are, they're older now. They want to do this every year. This has become our one tradition that we do in kind of a shifting world. Gratitude is really the best ingredient at the Thanksgiving table, I think.
Absolutely. This could have gone really political there for a second, and I'm glad it didn't. We got back to the romanticizing of the lordly turkey and where we're going to be. I think it's important to see past a lot of the conversation that's happening and to get back to those really basic ingredients. So now we're back here in 2025. Last year, Kendra, you talked about plans for a Friendsgiving, just a couple of couples. Your husband, Eric, was handling the bird. You were making some roasted Brussels sprouts with walnuts, maple syrup, dried figs, and a little bit of Parmesan.
That's right.
And so what's up for this year?
Well, as I always say, no two Thanksgivings look alike. This year, I'm traveling with my husband to the Midwest, where we will join his sister's in-laws for a big Italian-American Thanksgiving. Mm. And because I'm a guest, I have been politely discouraged from bringing anything. I may try to sneak
carry-on
in.
Rules are tough now anyway.
Right. I may do cranberry squares. There's a great recipe that we feature in the weekly from Cindy Rhodes, Cape Cod Select. Mm-hmm. But you know, a perfect gift I think Bostonians can always travel with are chocolate-covered cranberries.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice. And your cranberry squares are really good. I can attest you've brought them in. Thank you for doing that. Thank you also for all of your work for The Monitor and for your amiable expertise on cranberries and other subjects.
Thank you so much. Happy Thanksgiving, Clay.
Find links to all of Kendra's reporting and her previous appearances on this show in our episode show notes at csmonitor.com/whywerotethis. This episode was hosted by me, Clay Collins, and produced by Mackenzie Farkas. Jingnan Pong is also a producer on this show. Our sound engineers were Alyssa Britton and Ian Case. Original music is by Noel Flatt. Produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2025.